danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 293 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus, and sadly, I am Nateless today. I want to give a shout out to Andrew, not me, a listener named Andrew, who recommended today's guest, Thomas Pinnock. Thomas is a poker player, a medical student, and the creator of Zenith Poker, which is a free poker learning community. And you'll hear more during our interview about what exactly that is, where there's also a lot of strategy talk in the interview. I would say it's primarily a strategy-based interview. So I'm not gonna have a separate strategy segment, but I do wanna tell you a little bit more about the interview and give you a few other announcements before we get on to the interview proper. So I do want to emphasize, I think the content of the interview is really good. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in there about game theory and how to use solvers, including for people who are learning poker, not only for expert players, but at least at the time I was, you know, while we were recording, and maybe this won't come across as much on the interview, the conversation felt a little stilted to me. And I think what happened is that Thomas is in Australia, I'm in the United States. I think there was just a little bit of lag in our connection, like, you know, a fraction of a second. But even that really can be enough to throw off the kind of conversational pace that you're used to. So I don't know how much of this we were able to edit out. But I mean, I think you're going to hear a little bit of us sort of like talking over each other, or just like a slightly long pause after one person finishes talking and the other one starts or something. I just felt it like threw off the dynamic a little bit. But I do think the content is really good. And appreciate Andrew taking, or I appreciate Thomas taking the time. I appreciate Andrew recommending Thomas. A couple of the things I want to let you know. The first is I mentioned on last week's show, I'm doing a weekly, well, it might not always be weekly, but I'm doing a newsletter anyway, which is going to include some stuff that I don't blog about anymore. I mean, I don't really use the blog much at all anymore, except as like a podcast distribution mechanism. But I used to blog a lot about kind of random strategy thoughts that I had and hands that I played and stuff like that. And for a variety of reasons, I don't do that as often anymore, but I'd like to have a venue for doing that. So this newsletter is going to be a way for you to get access to some of the less fully formed poker thoughts that are flitting through my head. It's also going to be a place for me to announce news related to the podcast and new Thinking Poker products. Like we have a new premium podcast that's going to be coming out, the Carlos and myself. I'll have some more details about that in the newsletter. That should be available by the end of April. And there's going to be an exclusive discount for subscribers to the newsletter. So I would encourage you to sign up for that at thinkingpoker.net/newsletter. With episode 300 approaching, we are hoping to share some of your poker stories on the show. There's two ways that you can share those with us. You can email podcast@thinkingpoker.net, or you can go on Skype and place a call to Thinking Poker on Skype. No one's going to answer. You're just going to get a voicemail, and you can leave a voicemail with you telling your poker story. And by doing that, you are giving us permission to use that story on the air. You're giving us permission to edit or use only a portion of the story on the air. You're giving us exclusive rights to distribute and broadcast that story as part of this show. And you understand that you are not going to be compensated for that. #NickKest. Finally, of course, I need to tell you about Tournament Poker Edge. If you want more great strategy content, you are preparing for the World Series of Poker or anything else in Las Vegas or elsewhere, Tournament Poker Edge is an excellent resource for you. For as little as $25 a month, you can get access to my videos, not to mention hundreds of videos from dozens of other top players. You can sign up for that at tournamentpokeredge.com. Now, here is my conversation with Thomas Pinnock. So the little bit that I know about you, you're a poker player and a medical student, which sounds like a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
How did you get started playing poker?
Honestly, I haven't been playing poker for as long as most people. But I sort of got introduced to some home games through some friends. And then got more serious from there, and that would have been around 2016.
And I haven't been following closely the state of poker in Australia, but you're not able to play online now, right? Or at least not on PokerStars?
I was when I started, but over the past few years, there's been some changes to the legislation, and now the Australian players aren't able to play on PokerStars.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
There are a few sites that will host Australian players without regard to that legislation, but without PokerStars, the online scene has gone down.
Yeah,
understandably.
So where are you? Live. Are you mostly playing on those on the sites where you can play online, or are you playing live?
A mix of the two. But recently, starting my final year of study this year, so with that and running Zenith, which is the training group which I run, the playing of poker has gone to the backseat of teaching of poker.
Sure. I'm surprised you have time for much of anything with the med school. How much of your time each week does that take up?
Med school?
Yeah.
Med school technically is a full should be the equivalent of a full-time job.
Yeah, that's what I assume, or even more than that, I would think.
Yes. Well, it depends on how much time you dedicate to studying. Mm-hmm. A lot of med school is studying in your own time. And besides that, it's time on the wards, time inside hospitals, time inside clinical areas, stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that gives you the flexibility to sort of work poker in, I guess, my like understanding of a lot of people in med school, maybe this is more specific to U.S. med schools, is that it ends up being, you know, more like 60 to 70 hours or with the everything that they need to do for it.
Yeah, at times it definitely is like that. For some people, they struggle with being able to study as well as balance the clinical time, which they have to do. Mm-hmm. I've always been quite an efficient studier, so there's times where there's a lull in the clinical time, and so you in the amount of work that you have to do by the bedside, so you use that time to study, or in my case I use that time to study or work on my website or write my book. So it is pretty full on.
Yeah. And you were already in med school when you discovered poker?
Yes.
What was it about poker that grabbed you? I mean, I imagine you were already fairly busy. What made you sort of want to get interested in this hobby that it seems like I guess it's more than a hobby now, but you know, that you've ended up putting a lot of time into. I would think you wouldn't really be looking for more time sinks once you're already in med school.
Yeah, that is true. So how the medical school works in the school which I'm in is there was a requirement for a undergraduate degree. So medicine here is a 4-year postgraduate course, which is some like 45 weeks per year. But the prerequisite for that is having a bachelor's degree. So my bachelor's degree was in mathematics. specifically pure mathematics as well as probability and statistics. So in terms of the mathematics side of it, that's sort of where poker sort of grasped my interest. Mm-hmm. And this is on sort of a background of always having played games. I played chess as a kid, doing quite well in my state.
Was medical school always the plan? It doesn't seem like the most natural extension of mathematics. Or am I wrong about
that? No. So there was a... Here in Western Australia, there is ways to get into medical school, a guaranteed placement through high school. So I got in through one of those high school placements, and so I just did my undergraduate in something that I enjoyed in high school at the time.
Oh, I see. So you already knew that you were going to get into medical school, and so you could just sort of pick any undergraduate that you were interested in?
Yeah, essentially, that's right.
That's well, handy.
Any undergraduate, which I knew would have to do well in. Obviously, you had to do well in the undergraduate to keep your placement.
Yeah. I would think some people might be tempted to choose something easier than pure maths.
Well, for me, maths was easy. And maths is still pretty easy, and I keep it as a big part of my life, and my study of poker is very mathematical. Mm. And you'll see that in all the training that I do, the training and study content that I do. It's very maths-based. Looking towards sort of the game theory side of things, not just looking at what a solver has said, but the reasons why the solver is doing what it's doing and where the solver is going wrong.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get at that? Because I think it's been my experience helping people work with solvers as well, that's a lot of people's frustration is that whether it's your Pio or Poker Snowy, which is, I guess, not quite a solver, but same idea, it can give an output, but it can't really explain why it gives that output. And I think a lot of people struggle to figure out, you know, what to do with the output that they get. How do you determine, you know, what are the results? Well, I guess the two things. I mean, how do you determine which results to take seriously and which ones to say, no, Snowy's off on this one? And then also, how do you help people work backwards to figure out the why behind the outputs?
Yeah, so I'll break that down a little bit. So one thing is the difference between the AI implementation, like with Snowy, and with a much more rigorous implementation, like a Pio Solver or a GTO Plus. So with Snowy, as far as I know, Snowy is basically a neural network which has learned to play poker well by playing against itself over billions and billions of hands, possibly even trillions, I'm not exactly sure. And as a result, it is limited in its own architecture. So with Snowy in particular, Snowy can't split a hand between two bet sizes, in that it chooses its bet size before it chooses the action it wants to take with the hand. Another way to say that is that Snowy chooses the best bet size that it thinks it will have for its range, and then after that would decide whether those hands will bet or check into that bet size. And in the world of game theory and poker, this is the complete wrong way to do it. You should be looking at all of the possible bet sizes and picking the best bet size or bet sizes for the hand that you have, not the other way around. And so that's one of Snowy's biggest leaks post-flop. And because it has that leak, it'll end up in some strange turn and river spots where it will just come up with a very incorrect decision. So that's Snowy. So I wouldn't really trust Snowy too much going later into the game tree. Also, because going later into the game tree, it has literally less experience because the tree is so large. If it's played, say, a trillion hands in total, we might have only played a few hundred hands in that exact scenario. So its analysis of that situation might not be so fine-tuned yet once you get to the river. And in terms of the sort of iterative implementations with GTO Plus or Pyo Solver or Monka Solver or whatever solver that will be out next year, those are quite a bit better, but it's one of these garbage in, garbage out. If you put in incorrect ranges, if your tree is not great, right, if your tree is picking sizes which just shouldn't be used, if your tree is too small, which is a big thing that people overlook, all of these reasons will lead you to have a poorer or either a inaccurate or a imprecise look at what GTO is, what the game theory optimal solution is going to be. Imprecise in the sense that you're going to have either a low resolution picture of what you think game theory is, so your preflop ranges that you put in and the structure of the tree is okay, but the tree isn't big enough, so you get a low resolution picture, or you put in wrong preflop ranges, or you put in wrong bet sizes, or you've neglected some part of the tree, and so you get an inaccurate picture of what game theory looks like. And so once you understand how you can use the solver in an inaccurate or an imprecise way, you can understand some artifacts of the solution that you're looking at. All right, this part of the solution is just totally wrong. I shouldn't trust this part, or this part is better than this part. Or if I ran the same simulation using a slightly different tree, I'm going to get a similar result, which is going to be very close to what I think GTO looks like. And so knowing all of that, when you're studying the solutions from solvers, it's quite important to not just take what the solver is telling you. It's very important to sort of filter that and use your own judgment to see if the solver is making a mistake or how precise or accurate is my solution that I'm looking at. Can I implement the strategy which this solver has given me? Will the strategy help me make the correct play?
Yeah, and I think this is the frustration that a lot of less experienced or even just less theory savvy players have with tools like that, is they you know, fear, maybe correctly, that they don't have the capacity to make those judgments, and then the concern is, you know, maybe I'm just going to end up actually getting worse as a result of using these tools, which I think is something you do see. You know, you see people that are kind of incorrectly implementing these things or not understanding what the output really is. I'd be like, at what point do you think it makes sense, like in a poker player's development? Like, obviously, you have a much more serious math background than the obvious, you know, person who's starting in poker. Like, at what point do you think it makes sense for someone to start using those kinds of tools?
I think it makes sense very early on. It takes a lot of hands for a beginner to play to figure out that they should bet top pair, right? So like for an absolute beginner, they might not understand when they should bet or when they should check, and a solver will give you that. Even a low resolution solution will tell you roughly what you should be doing with big chunks of your range, right? You should be betting it at this stage roughly, and checking it at this stage, and calling at this stage, and folding at this stage. But those solutions might not be as beneficial to a beginner as sort of understanding why those solutions are the case, right? Why you should bet a very strong hand when you're in position on the river, and why it's okay to also bet some very weak hands. And as a beginner, it's not really intuitive why that's the case on the river. So looking at a solver and having the solver tell you that you should do that is fine for a beginner, but if they don't really understand why, then they might not get any the right amount of sort of learning from it. So it does help to have someone explain not just what the solver is saying, but why the solver is doing what it's doing. And so once you understand sort of why the solver is doing what it's doing in different parts of the tree, then you can sort of implement a strategy that's near to what a solver would do without ever having run the sim. So you might have looked at a bunch of very similar sims and then guess what you're doing from there, or you might sort of peer into what exactly the reason is the solver is doing this thing at this part of the tree. And in order to fully understand that, you sort of have to have a decent idea about what the maths is behind it.
Meaning, just like understanding game theory more broadly, like being able to form your own mental image of what a solution would likely look like so that you can compare it to a solver output.
Yeah, so the way that I do it in the way that I teach is similar to how the book The Mathematics of Poker has done it. Of course, The Mathematics of Poker was sort of written for like limit games. So I've sort of redone the math in a nicer way on my website. And what it goes through is a series of very simple games. And each of those simple games, you get just one or two sort of core principles about the structure of the game. So the most basic one is like the Ace King Queen game, right? So what do you learn in the Ace King Queen game is basically you should bet your strong hands, check your middling hands, and then sometimes bet your weak hands, right? So bet your strong hands to try and get value from the middling hands, check your middling hands because there's no point in betting, and to bet the middle hands to sometimes fold out. Sorry, bet the weak hands to sometimes fold out some stronger hands. Mm-hmm. And the combination of betting for your strong hands plus your weak hands ends up increasing your overall expectation. So that's a simple version of the Ace King Queen game. And then we build up on that. So we look at what does your opponent's range, what does the structure of your opponent's range have to look like, and in order to determine what your bet size is, right? So then knowing that, if I know that my opponent doesn't have many very many strong hands in their range, I can bet a bigger bet size with my strong hands, right? Mm-hmm. And if they don't have any strong hands at all their hands are pure bluff catches, you can comfortably bet all in. And so that would explain some things of what the solver is doing, right? So say you've got, this is a very broad example, say you've got a dry flop and you flop like middle or bottom set or something. You bet the flop, you bet the turn, and you've got like 4 or 5 times the pot in terms of the SPR on the river. It's often okay just to go all in there, as long as the turn and the river are bricks, because at that stage your opponent's range is completely bluff catches to your very strong hand.
And I get when you say
so, then the best play would be to bet like 3 to 5 times the pot as an all in.
Right,
and that, when that's you say not, like that's not intuitive to. Sorry, go on.
Now that I heard you say that, I'm curious to hear where you're going. When you say that's not intuitive, that might have been what I was about to ask.
Yeah, so it's not intuitive to beginning or even like middle strength players that you should just shove there with a set on the river. Give a more specific example. Say you open from the button, and then only the big blind calls, and you get a flop like. What's a good flop? Like Jack 7-3. Probably Jack 7-3 is probably not good. Let's go with Jack 9 deuce. And you've got, say, pocket 9. So you flop middle set. You bet the flop, you bet the turn, and the river, you end up with an SPR of like 3. As long as the turn and the river were relative bricks, you essentially have the nuts at this stage. Your opponent can't have a stronger hand than you. Right, and your opponent very rarely has a strong hand, which also blocks your hand. And so your hand is so strong that you can bet all in. And the math shows you exactly why this is the case. You actually have a very high expectation in betting all in.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people struggle with, or the reason why people's intuition doesn't bring them to that conclusion, is that they feel like those bet, like when they actually play poker, you know, people who learn poker through experience first rather than through like studying theory or understanding at a theoretical level, they're either concerned that, I mean, I think on one hand, people have like a psychological hang up of just like they want to win something when they have strong hands. And so even if like in theory, the highest expectation is shoving, like many people have, like their actual preference might be to have a lower EV, but to get some kind of bet called more often. And then I think there's also people, rightly or wrongly, reach the conclusion that opponents are just going to fold in that situation. That like when an opponent has a capped range and is facing a 3x pot bet on the river, they may just overfold in that circumstance. And I think now the corollary of that is, if you believe that that's true about your opponents, it may not make sense to make that overbet with sets, but it would make sense to make that overbet with bluffs, which many people don't take that next step. Like, I feel like what the solver is really telling you there is that overbetting a polarized range is the optimal solution, and a solution that's going to have a high EV. And if you are comfortable making exploitive assumptions about how your opponent is going to play, then you might be able to produce an even higher EV than that. But what doesn't make sense is just to say, well, you know, I'm just never going to make that overbet. Like, it may make sense to make the overbet in an exploitive way. It doesn't really make sense to say I'm not going to overbet value hands or bluffs. Like, I think when you see that kind of solver output, it's telling you you get to do some overbetting here. You can either do it with a balanced range, and that's like guaranteed safe, or you can do it in an exploitive way if you're comfortable, you know, making those kinds of assumptions.
Yeah, and one of the biggest thing about exploitative play is it only, and I think you might have gone through one of these in one of your earlier podcasts. Is that it only really makes sense if you sort of know what the optimal solution sort of looked like in the first place and why they're optimal in that way. So there, the example with a set or betting three times the pot, well, you're also going to do that with some bluffs, and that will make you balanced. But if you know that your opponent is overfolding, then the exploit would be to maybe not necessarily bet that big with the set. It might still be to bet that big with the set. But to also have more bluffs in there as well. And in terms of what you're doing with the set, it really depends on what your opponent is doing. If you know that your opponent will raise you often with a worse hand if you bet small, then often betting the set would be for a smaller bet size, which to induce a raise would be the better play there. So when you're thinking about exploits, it's important to know what the solution looks like, what the optimal solution looks like, and then also know sort of what your opponent is going to do to almost everything that you can do, right? So if you only limit yourself to only betting all in, or betting like a pot size bet, or three times a pot, and you only have those two choices, then you might miss out on some exploits that you could do if you bet like a quarter of the pot or one-fifth of the pot. If you know that if you bet one-fifth of the pot and your opponent is going to be too aggressive and raise you too often, then when you have a very strong hand like a set, it would be much better to do it that way, because that way your opponent is putting the money in for you, and they're putting it in for you too often.
Yeah, and I think this is another thing that a lot of people struggle with when using like Pio or something specifically, which, like you mentioned before, it's very dependent on your inputs. And if you, for instance, don't bother to ask it about making a quarter pot or a one-fifth pot bet, it's not going to give you that. You know, you're never going to uncover that sort of thing. Like, maybe there is a part of your range that would want to do that. Or, I mean, I know in this case you were talking about you were doing that for exploitive reasons anyway, but just like it's not even a part of the game tree that you end up exploring. But you, at the same time, like when you're using a tool like that, you do have to put some kind of constraints on it. Like, it can't actually solve no limit poker itself a form of poker where it's allowed to make certain bet sizes, which still gives it a lot more flexibility than, you know, Snowy, for instance. But I guess, how do you go about deciding how to make those critical choices in the first place about what question you're going to ask to FioSolver, like how you're going to constrain the game space in setting up a simulation?
Yeah, so the trick there then is really that you're asking about sort of the resource allocation. So for people at home who don't have solvers, solvers require quite a bit of RAM to fit the entire tree in when performing the computations. And the bigger the tree, the more RAM it uses. And the bigger the tree, the RAM requirements go up exponentially. So when you add a few more bet sizes in, the size of the tree could be a multiple of three or four times as big as only having fewer bet sizes. So the trick there is you have to consider the trade-off between accuracy and precision. So if you run a whole lot of lower resolution simulations, you might actually get to a very accurate representation of GTO from that by looking at all of them in sort of aggregate. All right, looking at each individual one might not tell you exactly what's going on, but looking at all of them together will give you a better idea of exactly what's going on. And you can do that with relatively low RAM. You just run multiple lower resolution simulations with a bunch of different bet sizes for each sim accordingly. One or two bet sizes per spot in each sim, but you alternate them from one sim to another. So for example, the first sim might look at 50% and 100% and have that as all of its bet sizes. And then the next sim you might look at 33% and 75%. And have that at all of those bet sizes. And so you might see something by looking at a bunch of these low resolution simulations. The other solution is to build as big a tree as you can and just try to have a high resolution picture. So then you get both a relatively precise and accurate picture of what's going on in terms of GTO, but the cost of that is it requires very high RAM. And part of Zenith is there's the sharing of simulations within the community. So all the sims that I run, I put up on the website, and other people can contribute their simulations as well for other people to look at. And so it's a very sort of time-saving thing having multiple people run simulations, looking at different spots and putting them up. Right, you might not dive very deeply into an individual simulation, and that's probably not the best idea. It's better to have a higher resolution, sorry, a higher stepping further back and looking at the painting from further away rather than getting real close and looking at the individual brush strokes kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Looking at multiple simulations and seeing if you can pick up certain trends out of the game tree, or if you can look at multiple simulations of a very similar spot, you would know roughly exactly which bet sizes you want to look at for using on, say, the flop and particular turns and particular rivers. And then when you, at some stage, you do have enough RAM to run a very large tree, then you can implement the bet sizes that you know are going to work. So I'll give you an example. Say you open from the button and the big blind calls, right? So you open for a small bet size, like 2 or 2.5, and the big blind calls. And the flop is a paired board with a high pair. Say, for example, you got King-King-7. Often the correct bet size to use there for a very large portion of your range is simply one big blind. The big blind checks and you bet the minimum. And betting the minimum is so far outside a lot of people's normal experiences of poker that they wouldn't think to run a sim with that. And you wouldn't have been able to pick that up unless you ran a whole bunch of sims with a bunch of different bet sizes in them. Right? And not just of that particular flop, but all paired flops. Right? So on all paired flops, or at least all paired flops with a high pair, it's almost always correct to just bet one big blind in that spot. And you wouldn't see that unless you ran a lot of sims on a lot of different boards with a lot of different bet sizes. You wouldn't see that. That's the recurring trend.
It's not something that I had investigated before. That's interesting to hear.
Yeah. And so you'll see stuff like that. Betting one big blind is correct there. In other spots, it's correct to split your range between a one big blind bet and an over bet. In other spots, it's correct to bet a variety of different bet sizes. But often, you'll see that the common bet sizes that people use day to day, stuff like between half the pot and the pot, actually isn't very optimal. It's often quite more optimal to bet quite a lot smaller or quite a bit bigger.
How do you strike?
And you wouldn't be able to see that.
Sorry, go ahead.
And you wouldn't be able to see that unless you ran a lot of sims and looked at a lot of sims.
Well, and I think also look at the EV difference. So I mean, like you can if you could run one sim, for instance, where you're allowing six different bet sizes on the flop, and that might have a slightly different or slightly larger EV than a sim where you only allowed one bet size on the flop, for instance. But then as a human, we might say, well, it's going to be very complicated for me to implement the five different bet size solution. And if I get it wrong and end up doing something exploitable, then I may end up actually doing less well than if I just implemented a more simple solution of like, betting my full range or like betting a bunch of logical betting hands for so-called common bet size. Like how do you strike that balance, I guess, between making it something that is actually implementable by humans who don't have access to unlimited storage and random number generators in our heads?
Yeah, so looking at the sims and seeing what is GTO is very different to actually trying to implement it. Often when you're playing, it's not super important that you're balanced all the time, because it's very difficult for other humans to pick up on that. As long as you're playing in a way that's very difficult for your opponents, that's probably the best way to play. So say, but going back to that paired board example, if you bet one big blind, it's actually very difficult for your opponents to continue in the correct way with a lot of their range. On a king seven, what do you do with 10-8? Do you call? Do you fold? Do you raise? And it's very difficult to do that, to figure that out against only a one big blind bet. If you call and then the turn misses, then what do you do, right? So it's very difficult for your opponents to be able to continue against that very small size. So in terms of the GTO way of playing, it's a very good way to play against humans because the humans can't figure that out. Other things that you see is overbetting the flop. If someone bets twice a pot into you on the flop and they're doing it correctly, it's very difficult for a human to be able to know what to do unless they've already studied that spot. They might have a top pair and a mediocre kicker, and they might not know what to do, right? They're facing, say, on an ace-king seven board or something like that, facing a 2.5 times pot bet on the flop as the out-of-position player, and they've got, like, ace-two. Very difficult to be able to know what to do if you've never seen it before. And then there's the splitting of different of the hands into the different bet sizes. If you have a hand that's okay at a variety of different bet sizes, often it's okay while in play to pick the bet size that you think is going to essentially make it the most difficult for the opponent that you're playing against. That's how you maximize your EV against this particular player. You know that if you're playing against Labradus or you're playing against a very strong bot or something like that, you would have to probably be a bit more balanced and pick the different bet sizes. But if you look at the sim and you see that this particular hand is okay for a variety of different bet sizes, from a small bet size to a very big bet size, you should just pick the bet size that you think makes it most difficult for your opponent. If your opponent is very good at facing large bet sizes, then don't pick a large bet size, right? But if they're very poor at picking at defending against large bet sizes, then you should put that hand in the large bet size range, right? And so that's looking at the exploits. The other thing is, in GTO, when you have a bet size on an earlier street, the expectation from that bet size comes from your knowledge of how to play the later streets. Might not be the case on the river, but definitely on the flop and the turn, the only reason why that bet size has that EV is because you know exactly what to do on all possible runouts, right? And then that would give you the solver EV.
Right, so you need to be thinking about both, like, how to push your opponent outside of his comfort zone, but also how to avoid ending up outside of your own comfort zone.
Yeah, when you play a lot of hands and look at a lot of solutions, you're not just looking at, oh, what does this hand do on the flop? It's how does this hand take the line that it takes to get to the river? How does this whole game complete for this hand? Is the way that is the best way to study, in my opinion. Because that way, when you're actually playing poker, you're thinking ahead. Okay, so you're on the flop. You have to sort of plan out the hand going forward, right? And that might not be okay in terms of a GTO point of view, where you want to make a random decision at every point. But you can actually do that on the flop. You can just decide on your randomness early on, and then when you get to that part of the tree, you've already made the decision on the flop. So say, for example, you're on the flop and you know that if the turn is a 10 or whatever, and your opponent bets this exact size, and you know that you have the option to either call or fold, and you want to do that randomly, you might make that decision on the flop rather than getting to the turn and then making the decision. But that would involve thinking, having already thought through all the different possible turns and rivers, and sort of making the decision on the flop. And that's a very difficult thing for a lot of people to do, sort of just thinking ahead a few steps. Mm-hmm. And it's not what you're sort of taught. Like, no one teaches you to think ahead. When you're playing chess, everyone teaches you to think ahead. But when you're playing poker, everyone wants you to think backwards, right? They want you to remember what had happened in the past and then sort of work that into the spot that you are now. But if you're very early into the tree, if you're just on the flop or you're just on the turn, you have to think to the next street. You have to think to the next two streets. And if you're pre-flop, you might have to think to the next three streets. Although it's very difficult to do that. Definitely on the flop. If you're on the flop, you want to make a particular bet size, you should know what sort of turns, what's going to happen, what your plan is on each particular turn card, at least.
Right, like if you make that min bet on the flop and your opponent calls, one of the things you should recognize is that his calling range is going to be much wider than it would be had you made a larger bet, or it should be anyway. You know, he should be calling with a much wider range than if you had bet, say, 3/4 of the pot. And one of the implications of that is that you're going to be barreling more often and probably with a larger size on later streets, which isn't to say that you're going to be barreling with every single hand on every single turn card, but you need to know that, like, broadly your game plan is likely to involve more barreling than it would if you had made a larger bet on the flop. And so if people are just kind of broadly thinking, like, well, you know, I continuation bet the flop and then I only follow through on the turn if I have some kind of equity, that's that's like a particular strategy that people have devised for a common method, which may not even be correct there, but you know, that I think that's like something that people have learned for a common bet size, continuation bet size used in No Limit, and they can't necessarily like pick that up and apply that in the context of having made a much smaller C bet on the flop.
Yeah, so going back to the small C bets, so the paired boards are just one example of where you can bet very small. Another example is very, very dry boards like a king 7-3 or queen 7-2. This is in the context of a single raised pot between the button and the big one. The play there is once you've bet very small with the majority of your range or your entire range, your opponent should have raised a lot of their very strong hands on the flop, like their two pair and sets and stuff like that, or at least the majority of them. And so when you get to the turn, the only very strong hands that they could have made come from that particular turn card. And so if that particular turn card is a brick, it doesn't provide any additional strong hands to your opponent's range. It also doesn't give any additional strong hands to your range either. And so you get into this situation where you have a lot of very strong hands and your opponent doesn't, but all of your bluffs just missed. So essentially your very strong hands will want to get max value as quick as possible. Now your opponent's range is capped. Your very strong hands can start betting multiples of the pot. So I'll give an example in the single raised pot between the button and the big blind. On a king 7-3 board, we bet one big blind as the button and the big blind calls, and the turn is like a 9. Right, so the 9 is a brick. It doesn't really bring too many strong hands to other players' range. Sure, some king 9 got there and some 7-9 got there, but it's mostly a brick. Other cards we might be a brick is like a 2. In spots like that, it's totally okay for you to have a very strong hand like ace-king or ace-queen to bet like 3 times the pot. And you can bet 3 times the pot with the intention of getting a lot of value and then checking back the river. And if you're the in-position play, you actually have the luxury of making plays like that, which is very different to how a lot of players are going to play a hand like ace-king or king-queen in that spot. A lot of players are just going to bet the standard 75% of the pot, and then on the river, if it's good, bet 75% of the pot. But if you look at the GTO solutions, the correct play with an ace-king, king-queen, king-jack type hand would be to bet 2 or 3 times the pot on this turn, and then if the river is good, continue betting, and if the river is bad, you can check back. And in order to understand that, you would have had to make that plan on the flop, right? You would have had to make that plan on the flop, understand that after I bet small, my opponent would have raised all their strong hands, so on this, and that turn, I can bet 3 times a pot.
This
and
reminds
then
me,
on this, and that turn, I can check the river or bet all in or whatever.
This reminds me of something I wanted to ask you when we were talking about Poker Snowy. It sounded like what you were saying then was that you felt like Snowy was relatively useful for, say, preflop decisions, and then less useful further down the game tree. Is that broadly correct?
Yeah, that's broadly correct. And the reason is that it has less experience later down the tree and has a lot more experience
right
preflopping on the flop.
And I was wondering, though, if you feel like Snowy is playing suboptimally on the later streets, wouldn't that also call into question the preflop? I mean, given that like its assessment of what it's worth to, you know, say call with king 5 suited from the big blind is based on the value of playing that hand on later streets, and it, you know, doesn't play that hand on later streets as well as say, you know, Pio Salver or Libratus would. Does that mean then, you know, that it's essentially missing an opportunity to make what would be a profitable call? Like, it's saying, I can't profitably call with this hand, but that doesn't mean that, like, a better player, someone who's going to take advantage of the full game tree on later streets, wouldn't be able to profitably call with that hand.
Yeah, so another one of Poker Snowy's leaks is that it's never indifferent between calling and folding preflop. So there isn't any spot, if you look at it as preflop solutions, where it will be indifferent between calling and folding. It'll either always call or always fold. And because of that, its post-flop range isn't quite as sort of dynamic as it could be. Right, there's certain particular flops where it will just be missing some hands which are necessary to defend effectively. And in terms of its assessment of preflop going towards the river, usually the mistake that it would make on the river sort of balance each other out across all the possible different turns and rivers and flops going towards preflop. Whatever small mistakes that it makes on the river is just diluted out, averaged across all possible runouts going back to preflop. And so its rough assessment of what the expectation is of calling or raising or whatever of a hand preflop is actually quite strong, because any small mistakes that it makes much further down the tree has been averaged out.
Interesting. So how do you think about Zenith Poker? I mean, do you think of it as a like traditional training site? Or, I mean, you used the word community before. I mean, is it kind of a we teach you how to play poker, or is it more of a like we're figuring out together how to play poker kind of approach?
Yeah, it's definitely more. It's a bit of both. It's very different to other training sites, as in there's the focus is on the community and community building. And all the training and all the content on the website is free. So anyone who wants to join the website and join the community is welcome to join at no cost. And the tutorials as well are also free to sign up to. And the focus is on sharing knowledge. So one example is that we decided to implement a mentoring program where you can sign up to either be a mentor or a mentee, and then you would get allocated at a particular date. So you sign up as either a mentor or a mentee, you give some information about yourself, what stakes you play, why you want to be in the program, how much time you can dedicate per month, and then from that, mentees and mentors are allocated together. And that's one way that the community sort of grows. Another way is in looking at the different hand histories. We've got multiple different just chat threads talking about hand histories and strategy and general chat and tournaments and cash game and live game and online and basically everything under the sun in terms of poker. And then there's the ability to just share what you know. So there hasn't been one recently, but one of the types of tutorials which we run is when a member of the community is the person that's doing the teaching. So there'll be some more with the mentoring program because I built that in. But what happens is that a member of the community prepares a presentation, right, on a particular topic that they like. And they know quite a bit about, right? Once that presentation is prepared, they're going to give a tutorial to the other members on that, right? So other members can come in and watch and ask questions, and they're being taught by that member of the group. And also that member of the group is one of the senior members. There is a bit of teaching on the website. There's all of the math, which will help you sort of understand why solvers are doing what they're doing, as well as some content based on the sort of best knowledge from the best solutions that we have available. So it's a combination of those two. So the stuff that's on the website is attempts to be the best of the best. So we're trying to get the best post-flop analysis up, the best pre-flop ranges up, right? The best sims up that we can in the library. And so it's trying to be the best training site slash community and also be free. And the only way that that can be done is if members of the community contribute to the community to help it grow.
So why the desire to make it free? I assume this was a fair bit of work on your part to at least get it off the ground. I don't know how much you have to do to actively manage it now, but I mean, it's valuable information to people. Why do you want to make it free?
So when I look back to chess, and I played chess for many years and still do from time to time, almost all of the best coaching and training content in chess is free. And there are very large communities, very dedicated communities to learning and growing as chess players out there. And so I wanted to make one of them for poker, because over the years that poker has been around, it's been mostly looked at as a game just of gambling and degenerates and stuff like that. It's become a bit less like that now, but the only way that the sort of game can gain in its nobility is to have communities dedicated to becoming good at the game, not just making money.
What do you think would be the value of that, I guess? I mean, for poker to have that more noble stature that chess does, what do you see as the advantages of that?
A lot more in terms of having more people play. So almost everyone is taught chess as a kid, right? Chess is a very pervasive, it's a very common game that people have played for millennia. And the only way that poker can sort of get to a status even near what the likes of chess or Go would be is by making sure that people think of poker as a game of skill and not just luck. And a lot of people, when they first learn about poker, they think about it, oh, just to gamble. They're not introduced to the idea that you can win in poker by playing well. And the only way to do that is to let people learn how to play well for free. A lot of the content that's up on the website, up on the internet, that's free already is either outdated or just not good. It's just not correct, or if it's correct in some way, it's not explained properly in a way that a true beginner could sort of grasp it.
I guess I'm still kind of inclined to. I mean, obviously, like I enjoy poker and like poker, and I'm happy to see more people play poker. But so what? Like, so what if people don't? If like never, not nearly as many people play poker as play chess. I guess what I mean to ask is like, what's the societal value of having more people play? But if that's how you think of it at all, like I think people might say, well, chess kind of like just playing chess sort of like makes our population smarter in general, or this is like the reason that we play games. I mean, obviously like individual people have their own reasons for playing games, but like as a society, the reason we've like evolved to play certain games is that we find it's useful for people in our society to have those skills or something along those lines. And do you think there's an argument like that for just kind of like cultivating general poker knowledge in the world population?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of poker is very mathematical and probability based. And if you sort of understand, just have a good intuition about how to play poker, you have already a good intuition about stuff like variance and probability theory. So, like, The unfortunate thing is that because poker technically is a gambling game, you can't teach it to junior school kids, right? You can teach them about cards and the chances of certain cards being on top of the deck, etc. But you can't teach the nitty-gritty about the mathematics and the structure of the game to young kids. And the reason why that's the case is because for very many years, poker's been thought of as a sort of degenerate game. And so if we can improve its nobility, then it could be the case that within a few years' time, you could have poker tournaments for kids, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But the idea would be you would win sort of, and they do this for chess all the time, right? They have many tournaments run throughout the years for kids all over the world, where the kids would be playing poker against each other and the best player would win a trophy or whatever, right? And so those players who start out as children, some of them might become very, very good. Some of them might just enjoy the game throughout their entire lives and become very hardworking citizens and have a deeper understanding of mathematics and probability theory because of their time in poker, and apply those skills to a different area of their life to provide that value back to society.
Yeah, personally, I feel like I got a lot of those skills from poker. I feel like it has kind of had that influence on me. At the same time, you know, I've also played poker with a fair number of people who have been playing poker for their entire lives, which might be 10, 20, sometimes even 30 or 40 years. And those people still seem to lack even the most direct knowledge of how to apply statistics to cards, let alone, you know, extracting a lesson from poker that they're applying elsewhere in their lives. Do you think that's too cynical of me?
I mean, yeah, that's fine. Some people like to play a particular game because they like to play the game and they won't ever study it, or they won't study it in the correct way. They might read a book here or there throughout their life and not try to become better at it. And in terms of a poker point of view, that's totally fine because they end up in some way providing the income to the very strong players, right? And in sort of the same way with chess, in addition to sponsorship, having a very large following for some of the strongest chess players in the world provides the sponsors to be able to sponsor the very strong chess players to devote their entire lives to playing the game. So having more poker players or more people be interested in poker in an intellectual way would mean that there's more scope for very strong and talented players to reach the highest levels and not just have luck win the biggest tournament of the year. So when you hear about very strong players like Fedor Holtz or whoever's strong these days, I'm not really keeping up with it, but Fedor Holtz won, you know, he didn't just win a few big tournaments, he won multiple tournaments over a period of a few years, right? And so in order to have players that can do that, you need to have a large following, right? You need to have a lot of people with their eyes on poker, not just have a lot of people who enter the tournament.
Yeah, fair enough.
If there is sponsorship, then it could end up being the case where tournaments don't need rake, right? Because if they're sponsored, if a lot of people are watching it, then these tournaments might not need rake in order to be sustainable. And so having a low rake or even a negative rake tournament would attract a much larger field.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the idea behind the Epic Poker. I guess that was a little before your time in the poker world, but Annie Duke and a few other people were trying to put together sort of a pro tour. It wasn't, they weren't open competitions, but there was no rake on the tournaments, and then there was like $1 million added free roll for people who did particularly well in their tournament. They were all like invitational tournaments at the end of the year, but they ended up not having $1 million and folding before they got around to doing the free roll for people. So it's quite a few folks were upset about that. So people who want to join the Zenith Poker community, just zenithpoker.com?
Yes, that's right. Zenith is Z-E-N-I-T-H, so Zenith Poker. So you can either Google it or just go straight to zenithpoker.com. And we've got a very strong, a very budding community on Facebook. So if you go to the website and then click the forum button, it will take you to that Facebook site. The Facebook group.
Perfect. That was my next question. Anything else you want to leave people with?
I think the most important thing is that solvers, they look scary to start off with, but the reason why a lot of people are scared of them is because they don't know why the solver is doing what it's doing. And if you know why the solver is doing what it's doing, and if you know why the solver might be wrong with the solution that it's presenting you, you can take the good parts that you learned from the solver and ignore the bad parts. And the good parts are going to improve your game, and you won't get clogged down by the bad parts and the nitty-gritty.
Well said. Thanks for taking the time. And enjoy. Well, I guess for you it's probably bedtime, but have a good week, I guess.
Cheers.
Take care.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.